All right, so I want to say thank you to Aaron, who is not here, for filling in for me in really one of the more thankless filling in spots, which is the end of Leviticus, and he did it, and I appreciate that so much, and he also did it with great enthusiasm, so I appreciate that. We are in the book of Numbers now, and we're going to finish the rest of our quarter in Numbers. So I've got on the board where we are tonight, and you can kind of see we're about at the midway point in the quarter, at least in terms of our lessons. And we're going to spend, you can look at next week, which I have some sheets that are for next week. I had intended to leave some sheets to prepare you for this class in the back. I think I got mixed up on all of that, and just in my haste to get everything ready, didn't get that done. But I do have sheets for next week, but you'll notice that next week we're only covering these two chapters, where we send the spies in to spy out the land, and it becomes a crisis, sort of a generational crisis. And we'll spend our time next week focusing on that one. I thought we should slow down because that's an obvious vital moment in the book of Numbers and really in the Old Testament history itself. And you'll see we can move forward from there. But that's the plan. That's where we are tonight. We're going to be covering chapters 5 to 12. And what's new in this, since we started this class in the beginning of Leviticus, we're sitting at the foot of Mount Sinai, and we have been the entirety of all of these weeks. We've just been receiving the law, and we've been talking about maybe what's going to happen when we get into the land, but we haven't been moving toward the land. That will change tonight, and the rest of Numbers, we're going to be sort of moving toward that. So there is some shifting there, and the book of Leviticus does not have, except for chapters 9 and 10 of Leviticus, which were the sort of initiation of the priesthood, the first sacrifices, and then Nadab and Abihu kind of botching that. Other than that, we didn't have any narrative action in all of Leviticus. There was nothing happening. We were just receiving law. But now in the book of Numbers, once you get past the numbers, which fortunately Aaron took care of for us last week, now we can move forward into the action of moving toward the land. So what we're going to focus on tonight is the idea of following and not following Yahweh in the desert. Because I want you to see there's a theme that the author here makes progress for us, where we start by moving and we move at the command of Yahweh, and then there are times where Yahweh's command does not please the people, or the way he is leading does not please the people, and they choose not to follow him, and there are consequences for those rebellions. So here is sort of broad strokes, these chapters. Numbers 5, we have the official separating the unclean from the people. We talked about that a lot in Leviticus. The people who are unclean need to be put outside the camp. That happens in chapter 5. We'll also talk a little bit in a second about this test for adultery, which if you read, you're probably wondering what on earth is going on with the water and all of that. So I don't have great answers on that, but we'll at least talk about it. Number 6 is the Nazirite vow and the Aaronic blessing. May Yahweh bless you and keep you. Number 7 is tribes bringing offerings. That's the one that, that's the one that you realize when you read the first one. All the others are just like it. They bring the same offerings again and again. Numbers 8, we have the lampstands and the Levites are prepared. Numbers 9, we celebrate the Passover, whether the first or second, depending on how you read that. And then we set out from Sinai. So then, chapter 11, we get the complaints about food and two different judgments in chapter 11. And then in chapter 12, we get the complaints against Moses by Miriam and Aaron, and there is judgment on that. So that's kind of broad strokes. We're not going to get into every part of it because we only have a limited amount of time, but I thought we would at least say here's kind of what's happening as we go through the text. All right, so in Numbers 5, I mentioned this a minute ago, we have the removing of the unclean from the camp. You see that in the first four verses. Verse 4 says, "And the people of Israel did so and put them outside the camp." So everybody who's leprous or everybody who's unclean, we put them outside the camp until they meet the conditions for making the sacrifices to be declared ceremonially clean. And as the Lord said to Moses, so the people of Israel did. Then we have this long section in verse 11 to 31 that is, in my version, it just says a test for adultery. And so you have this process where a husband becomes jealous of his wife and suspects that she has been unfaithful to him. All right, so just imagine that scenario, and then it is a problem that doesn't have a good solution. And particularly when you think about the ancient world and the way the ancient world dealt with men and women and husbands and their authority over wives in the ancient world. I'm not just talking about in Israel, just in the ancient Near East generally. Basically, a husband could have accused his wife and maybe even killed her or had her killed and said, you know, I think she's cheated on me. And then maybe he tells the other elders of the community or in the tabernacle, the gathering, and says, hey, I think she's committed adultery. What's the penalty for adultery according to Leviticus? Death. Okay? So basically, if this goes in the wrong way, in the ancient world, a man could just say something and then his wife be put to death. Okay? I can at least see Numbers 5 as a way of combating that. Because Numbers 5 says we're going to involve God. God's going to be involved in how we determine whether someone's jealousy is appropriate, whether someone actually has committed adultery, or whether everything is okay. So I like to think of this way. And so if you haven't read it, I just encourage a brief reading where there is a certain kind of water that she's supposed to drink. And basically the water brings a curse if she is guilty of what she's accused of. And if not, you know, everything is intended to go back to normal. So I see that as an appeal to divine judgment with an unsolvable case. We just don't have the evidence, and this is one of those where there's no way of knowing what really happened because it's basically one person's word against another. And I mentioned this, it prevents a jealous husband from punishing on suspicion alone. A lot of the commentators talk about what's called a trial by ordeal. I don't know how familiar you are with that idea. It happened a lot in the Middle Ages, and in fact, we're probably most familiar with it from like the Salem witch trials and accusing someone of being a witch. And so what would happen would be, you know, you throw them in a river, and if they're innocent, then they're not going to die, and if they're guilty, they die, okay? And in the ancient world, by the way, that didn't originate in Massachusetts, that originated, well, I don't even know if it originated, but it was a part of Hammurabi's code in Babylon way, way back in the time that we're discussing. So the idea then was God is going to determine whether someone's guilty by basically saving the innocent person, but if God doesn't do anything, then the guilty person just dies. In other words, they're going to do something that would kill them and then just assume that they're guilty if they die. Okay? This is different. Okay? What we're reading in Numbers 5 is different. I know that may sound strange and barbaric because it is strange and barbaric. Numbers 5 is different. Numbers 5 is, you know, she's going to drink this water, and if she's innocent, it's just not going to hurt her. Nothing's going to happen. But if she's not innocent, something sinister, a curse will come upon her, and that's expected to be something that God does. So a lot of the commentators point out that there's a difference there between what Numbers 5, how Numbers 5 works, and the Babylonian rituals that they went through. It's an interesting thing. I don't know how helpful it is for us, but just thought I'd point it out because I've been reading about it, and sometimes when you read about something over and over again, you want to share it with people when you have a chance, right? So that's what I just did. All right, number six. Discusses Nazirite vows. Nazirite vows allowed certain people to separate themselves to the Lord. I notice in verse 2, it says, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazirite to separate himself to the Lord. So notice that both men and women are allowed to do this, which is very interesting. We don't have records of women being Nazirites. We only have a couple of records of men being Nazirites. Some of the Old Testament records seem to not be someone choosing to separate themselves. Who is the most famous Nazirite in the Bible? Samson. Did Samson decide to dedicate himself to the Lord? No, how'd that happen? Everybody's kind of muttering. An angel came and told his parents he's going to be a Nazirite, right? And so he had all these rules about everything that, you know, the Nazirite rules are. Basically, there were three rules for a Nazirite. One is don't drink wine or have anything to do basically with any grape and any kind of product of the grape. It's like as far as you can get from any kind of wine. And then there was don't cut the hair. And then there was don't touch dead bodies or don't be around dead bodies. And if you are accidentally in the presence of a dead body, this text even says your Nazirite vow is like canceled. Like, nope, you blew it. And what's interesting about that is that Samson seems to defile all of those, you know, his own Nazirite vow. Definitely the hair, definitely the dead bodies, because he creates a lot of dead bodies and corpses of animals and such. And so, like, there is, it's funny to read that story that way. Funny, I guess it's kind of sad to read that story that way, but it may be that Samson is, you know, he's supposed to be holy to God, but he decides not to be. So basically, this is a vow that people could take on themselves when they said, I want to be someone specially devoted to God, and I want to do something in honor of God. So that's the idea of the Nazarites. I'll talk more at the end. I do wonder, when we get into the book of Acts, if that's not the vow that Paul takes, where it describes how there is a vow, and he's going to cut his hair and then take a vow. And I don't know of any other vows that are that spelled out. It seems like probably, even though Paul is a Christian, he still has this special vision of, I want to take this vow to be holy to God for this certain amount of time. The instructions in chapter 6 also tell you how to kind of end the vow when the time comes and you say that's enough, and you offer these sacrifices and kind of go on your way. All right. Also, just briefly, at the end of chapter 6, verse 24 to 27, you have the blessing that Aaron is supposed to speak, or the priests are supposed to speak, to put Yahweh's name on the people. Verse 24 of chapter 6, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So shall they put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them. Sometimes we miss that because the translation says the Lord, but that's the name of God. I keep saying Yahweh. That's the best we know to do with that word in Hebrew. But basically, it's my name, my name, my name. The Lord, the Lord, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his countenance to shine on you. So what he's saying is, put my name on them, speak my name, bless them in my name, so that my name goes with them. We still sing a song, the Lord bless you and keep you. I think it's the one with all the amens, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, that's why we're afraid of it. So, great song. It's certainly very scriptural. It's the same Aaronic or priestly blessing passage. Let's see, number 7. I was reading this today. I was reading a commentary that said, this is the most repetitious section in all of Scripture, and therefore the most neglected, or something like that. And I thought, yeah, it kind of is. I don't know if you got all the way through chapter 7. At some point, if you read it once, and you read the first family and the first tribe, and then you see the second one's the same, the third one's the same, you kind of say, why don't we skip to the end? And I think that commentator is saying that's what everybody does. In fact, it's kind of what he did in the commentary. He just kind of lumped it all together. So the tribes bring offerings at the dedication of the tabernacle. So we're still kind of in that mode where we're getting everything up and running. And then there is this section that talks about the wagons and oxen in verses 3 to 6, and how there are wagons and oxen that are there specifically for the Levites to use in the transportation of the tabernacle. Remember, we're going to be moving, and we're going to move, and certain Levites have the tear down the tabernacle responsibility, and certain other ones have to cover up the special things and move them in this way. That's especially going to be important when you have Uzzah, who is not supposed to be, you know, monitoring the ark as it goes on a cart, but instead the ark is supposed to be carried on poles, as you see in the instructions in Leviticus. And so here we're providing for them to be able to do their work, to transport all these things in the way that God expects them to. All right, I don't have anything on chapter 8. Chapter 8 talks through the lampstands, and then more about sort of consecrating the Levites. But I want to look in chapter 9. Oh, let me stop for a second. Am I missing anybody? You got thoughts, comments through chapter 8 here? Yeah, Scott?
Even though the chapter is repetitious, as you mentioned, I think there is some significance. Each tribe had a part, and they all offered the exact same thing. There was no superiority of one to another. God was with them all. I don't know. I think there's something to be said about that, although it's tough to read because it's the same thing over and over again. But nevertheless, they were all expected to bring the same gift to God in the consecration of the tabernacle.
Mm-hmm. I'm hearing some of that. Every part does it share, you know, the idea of the church, that we all have something to contribute, and that it's all equally valued by God, even though we might say, well, it's not exactly the same thing like it is in this section, but the idea is the same. It's not as if one tribe does a lot more than another tribe. It's viewed in the same way because they're bringing the same thing. Good thought. Anything else that you guys want to say through chapter 8? Okay, chapter 9. So a couple of things here, and then I kind of want to slow down when we get toward the end of the chapter. First is Israel keeps the first or second Passover. I put first or second for a reason. The first Passover was in Egypt, right? Okay, the first Passover, if you want to get technical, they kept the Passover, they smeared the blood, and they threw out the leaven, and they did all the things God said then. But this is sort of the first time we're going to observe the Passover as the ritual it's going to become. It's the first time now we're out of the land of Egypt, and we're observing it in a new way. We're not living there. In fact, I'm not even sure what the lintels, I'm assuming they're living in tents. I don't know what the doorposts look like of the tents they have, but they're doing this in a new setting, in a new place that's going to be kind of the way they do it over the next generation until they get into the land, when then it will probably change again because the setting is changing. But we're now keeping what God told us to keep. And there is an interesting sort of problem that emerges as they keep it this time. Look in verse 6 of chapter 9. It says, "There were certain men who were unclean through touching a dead body, so that they could not keep the Passover on that day. And they came before Moses and Aaron on that day. And the men said, 'We're unclean through touching a dead body. Why are we kept from bringing the Lord's offering at the appointed time among the people of Israel?' And Moses said to them, 'Wait, that I may hear what the Lord will command concerning you.'" So they seem, what's interesting about this to me is, for one, they're ceremonially unclean because they've been around a corpse. For two, they try to go keep the Passover, and they are prevented. So someone is there saying, "No, you can't do this." And they are sort of offended, at least the way I read it, like, why are we being kept from doing this? We're trying to do what God said, and yet you're stopping us. And so here Moses says, okay, well, let me talk to God about this. Obviously, you want to keep the Passover. You're unclean. How does God expect that to work? So verse 9, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the people of Israel, saying, if any one of you or your descendants is unclean through touching a dead body, or is on a long journey, he shall still keep the Passover to the Lord. In the second month, on the 14th day at twilight, they shall keep it. They shall eat it with," "they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. They shall leave none of it until the morning, nor break any of its bones. According to all the statute of the Passover, they shall keep it. But if anyone who is clean and is not on a journey fails to keep the Passover, that person shall be cut off from his people because he did not bring the Lord's offering at its appointed time. That man shall bear his sin." So, here's what he says. Basically, you can have a makeup Passover a month later. Okay, next month, you're all clean, everything. Or if you're on a long journey and you're not able to get back in time, you come and you do it on the second month. But it's also interesting. He says, it's like God knows us. He says, but if you're at home and you're clean and you just don't want to keep the Passover and you want to wait for makeup Passover, it's like, nah, that's not working. Okay, so observe it, but God is understanding about the fact that there will be circumstances that might occur where we can't keep it the way we would like to or the way he commanded us to. So he allows a sort of exception there to observe it a month later. All right, so I want to slow down a little bit in verse 15, and I kind of want you to now transition with me into, we're getting ready to talk about leaving. We've been at the foot of Mount Sinai ever since. We kind of wandered out of Egypt. We had a little trouble along the way where we had some problems with food and water, but now we're here at the foot of Mount Sinai, and we're ready to go toward the promised land. And so we're going to slow down and really talk about what's happening here, starting in verse 15. It says, "On the day that the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony. And at evening it was over the tabernacle like the appearance of fire until morning. So it was always. The cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night. And whenever the cloud lifted from over the tent, after that the people of Israel set out, and in the place where the cloud settled down, there the people of Israel camped. At the command of the Lord, the people of Israel set out, and at the command of the Lord they camped. As long as the cloud rested over the tabernacle, they remained in camp. Even when the cloud continued over the tabernacle many days, the people of Israel kept the charge of the Lord and did not set out. Sometimes the cloud was a few days over the tabernacle, and according to the command of the Lord, they remained in camp. Then, according to the command of the Lord, they set out. And sometimes the cloud remained from evening until morning, and when the cloud lifted in the morning, they set out. Or if it continued for a day and a night, when the cloud lifted, they set out. Whether it was 2 days or a month or a longer time that the cloud continued over the tabernacle, abiding there, the people of Israel remained in camp and did not set out. But when it lifted, they set out. At the command of the Lord, they camped, and at the command of the Lord, they set out. They kept the charge of the Lord at the command of the Lord by Moses. Does that seem redundant to you? I mean, it's not a hard concept, right? Like, cloud, we go where the cloud is. Cloud leaves, we leave. Cloud stays, we stay. Like, I just did that in like 10 words. And yet he goes on and on and on. So I want you to think about that. I want you to think about why that would be so repetitive, because I believe there is a point. For one, we are describing how Israel is following Yahweh God. We are following Yahweh. Where Yahweh leads, we go. Everywhere he goes, everywhere we go, we're following. He is leading us. So there's never any question about, are we in the right place? Or did we get off course? Or where are we headed? Or is Moses just drunk on his own power? Which will come up later. And then it also uses this phrase, they leave when he leaves, and they do so at the command of the Lord. Or at some points it says, the charge of the Lord. The command. But as far as I read it, there is no verbal command. Go when I go. Everyone come, and then we go. No, it's instead just that simple process of, here's the cloud, we follow the cloud. So, think about what that would teach the people. It would teach the people that Moses is not in charge, God is in charge. That they are not in charge, God is in charge. But I also want you to think about, what does that mean if we're in a place where there's not any water? Something go wrong? Or if we're in a place where we really wish there was different, better food? Something go wrong? Or we get to the cusp of a land and we realize that the land is full of people who are too big for us and we can't take it over. Did something go wrong? Just think about that. What we're really saying is, if God's in charge of the mission, it creates a certain attitude in us. It says, I don't really understand exactly where we are, where we're going, why we're doing it this way, but I know that I'm doing the will of God. I'm following at the command of the Lord. And I believe this is one of the reasons why when we start having problems along the way, God gets so angry. Because we're going to see it in just a second, that it's not just that God says, all right, I'll be patient with you. Let me explain myself. It is instead that the anger of the Lord burns against them as they go along the way. And I want you to think about why. Just think about it from God's perspective. He is literally with them in a visible form. They can see him. He's going over here. They go over here. And then they, when they get where they're going, I wonder if they just look around and say, this place, why are we here? Like, it's just rocks. It's just desert. And so they are, in a sense, rebelling against God, not by not following, but instead by following with that attitude that says, I'm not sure about this, and I might want to go back. I don't want to follow you anymore because you're leading me to places I don't want to go. So I want you to get that picture in your mind as we approach what's going to happen in chapters 10, 11, and 12. All right? Any thoughts on that before we leave chapter 9? Okay. So chapter 10. So let's look down in verse 11, chapter 10 and verse 11. It says, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony, and the people of Israel set out by stages from the wilderness of Sinai, and the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. They set out for the first time at the command of the Lord by Moses. All right, so we're ready to leave. And verse 12 is a verse that it's not as immediate as it sounds. It sounds like, if you read verse 12, like they immediately went to the wilderness of Paran. And actually what he is describing in that verse is the set of movements that's going to get us all the way down to chapter 12 and verse 16. So we're talking about like two chapters of movements. And it says that they move there by stages, which means, you know, we go a few miles and we stop. And then we have some kind of crisis, which we'll see. And then we go to another place and we stop and we have another crisis and we have another problem. And then finally we get to the wilderness of Paran. okay, which is somewhere, by the way, it's not something I can give you a map and say, here's the wilderness of Paran. For one, it's a wilderness. For two, all we know is it's probably north of Sinai, between Sinai and Canaan, as we are heading up toward Canaan, at least between Sinai and Kadesh Barnea, where we'll get in chapter 13. So the other part here, if you look down in verse 29 in this section of Numbers 10, you have just every once in a while, you get this reminder that Moses was a real person and had a family. And so I don't know if you guys recall when we read this in our congregational readings, but back in Exodus 18, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, comes to him, and he sees Moses judging the people all day, and he says, this is not good. You know, wear yourself out. You need to spread the wealth. You need to get other people who are going to do the judging and the smaller cases and then give the harder cases to you. And Moses listened to his father-in-law, which, I don't know, for some of us may be harder than others. I don't know. But he listens to his father-in-law, and that ends up being a blessing for him. Here, you have Moses dealing with his brother-in-law. Verse 29, it says, Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel the Midianite, I assume Reuel is another name for Jethro, that is Moses' father-in-law, we're setting out for the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will do good to you, for the Lord has promised good to Israel. But he said to him, I will not go. I will depart to my own land and to my kindred. He said, please do not leave us, for you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will serve as eyes for us. If you do go with us, whatever good the Lord will do to us, the same we will do to you. And we don't get any of the response that Hobab had to him. So I assume that means he comes with them. That it's one of those, no, I don't think I'm going to go. No, really, you need to come. Come on, it'll be good. And then there's sort of like the, okay. And so he comes along. I just want to point out, Moses is willing to receive advice and counsel from other people. You'll be eyes to us. You'll tell us where to go and where not to go. Remember, we're following the Lord, but there's also some sense in which Moses is going to say, this is a good place to camp, or this is a good place to avoid. And so he says, you will help us. You'll be our eyes. Moses is willing to receive advice and counsel from others, provided they're not in rebellion. I think if you've read further along in Numbers, you know why I added that last point. Because there are people who are going to give Moses advice and counsel, and the advice and counsel is basically, you need to back off and let me be in charge, or you need to get rid of that woman you married, like we'll talk about in chapter 12. And Moses doesn't listen to that, but here I don't think we can look at this and say, oh, Moses is just, he's just got an iron fist, and he doesn't want anybody else to help him, because Moses is very submissive to these other people coming in and contributing, and he's also willing, like with the courts in Exodus 18, or like the 70 we'll talk about in chapter 11, he's willing to share power, provided people are not in rebellion. That's a different matter, okay? So now we're into chapter 11. So chapter 11, let's read about the people here. Chapter 11 is our, I would say, our first major crisis as we're on the road. Verse 1, and the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So the name of that place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. So it just says they complained. My version has the word misfortunes. They complained about their misfortunes. Does somebody have a different word there than misfortunes? Hardships. Calamity. Okay. I think we probably would get it. They've been slaves in Egypt. And probably, you know, you're so excited to get out of Egypt. And then what do you find? You find you're living in tents in the desert. You're staying at this mountain. And now it's like, all right, it's time to go. Let's go to the promised land. And a few days in, you realize, I'm still in the desert. Nothing seems to have changed. It's going to be hard. I think any of us, even the hardiest campers we have in here, are going to say, you know, a year or two in the Arabian desert, no thanks. Sinai Peninsula, no thanks. So there's a challenge there. They have misfortunes, they have hardships, they have calamities, and we don't know exactly what they're complaining about. But it is clear that God views their complaining as rebellion because God is angry. Now, you've already heard why I think that happens, because I think God is leading them and they're saying, I'm not happy with your leadership. This shouldn't be this way. And so the proper attitude I think God's looking for is a little more trusting and submissive than complaining. I will also say, just like what we're going to talk about in a minute when we talk about the craving, I think this was more than, oh man, my dogs are barking today. I think this is a little more than, man, are we ever going to get there? I think it's a little more formal, and I think it's a little more rebellious, because I don't think that the sort of everyday observing that things are hard is what makes the fire of the Lord burn. But what we read here is that there is a judgment. It's fire. It says it burns some of the outlying parts of the camp, which is not really specific enough for us to know. Do people die here? Is it just, you know, there's stuff happening and people are not really sure, why is this happening? Why is there fire? But they are scared and they pray to God, or ask Moses to pray to God. Because remember, from the Exodus, he's good at that. And when Moses prays for stuff, it works. And so they reach out to him. But this is just one scene, and we only get these three verses about it. But it's sort of a prelude to the next one. So verse 4, now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving. And the people of Israel also wept again and said, oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at. All right, so this is a more specific complaint. We're told what it is, and the people grow frustrated. I read it as they're frustrated with the blandness of the manna because of the nature of the stuff that they're wanting. It's all very, you know, flavorful, interesting, variety. They also say, you know, it's free. How did they get the manna? They had to go collect it, right? Now, they didn't have to pay anybody for it. Well, you didn't have to go bend over and pick it up, right? Every day. I don't know if that's part of the complaint, because they do say in verse 5, the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing. Why did it cost nothing? Probably because they're slaves being fed. Okay, I think they forget that part, but it's in the nature of the idea of being complaining. As any of us could say, you know, that a complaining heart really tends to only see what we're frustrated with in the moment, not the broader picture of how we've been blessed. It does say in verse 4 that it calls them the rabble in my version. Some versions say something like the mixed multitude, which is interesting because it sounds like we're pointing out that maybe there's some kind of Egyptian element, some people that might have come with them out of the land, but people are not children of Israel. But it also says, it kind of distinguishes them from, in verse 4, the people of Israel also wept again. So maybe it is Egyptians. And they're saying, man, things were great back home. Why are we here? And then the Israelites begin to say, you know what? You're right. And they begin to kind of catch their complaining. I'll just add this. Have you noticed that complaining is contagious? And when you complain to me, I say, man, I know. And then I start complaining back, and then we just kind of keep escalating the complaint. I wonder if that's not part of what's happening here. I will also point out, I put it's not mild. This is not like, oh, shucks, I wish I had a steak right now. This is something a little more serious, because it says in verse 4, they're weeping. It says in verse 10, Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent. Okay, this is not, aw, shucks, like they're crying. They're desperate. They're frustrated. And I want you to at least see how that could be. Like, before we're just condemning them because obviously they rebel against God here, I think we miss something if we think that we could never have that heart or that struggle. Where I have been glib in the past thinking about this story and just kind of said, what more does God have to do for you, you know? And then I look at my life and I say, I do this all the time, where I take the blessings of God and then complain about every little thing that I don't like. Just think about, if you were in a really desperate situation, you didn't know when it was going to end, you didn't know how it was going to go, and, you know, sometimes we just kind of break down a little bit. And I think that's part of what's happening here. You also have this part of it, which is Moses is frustrated because he feels like this is a complaint against him or criticism of his leadership. And the way I read this, I don't know that Moses is frustrated with the people as much as he is with God, because Moses complains to God. Like verse 11, Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child to the land that you swore to give to their fathers'? Where am I to get meat to give all this people?" By the way, can we just take a second and say there is a place in scriptural prayer for telling God what we're feeling and being open and honest, even if it doesn't come out with the right attitude? Moses does not have a, what's the word, reverent-seeming attitude here. I would not characterize his tone as reverent, but he is being honest. He is saying, this is how I feel, this is how frustrated I am, and I'm frustrated with you, God. And God does not rebuke Moses for his tone. He does correct him, because there are some things he needs to remember and some things God's going to do for him. But I would just add as an aside while we're here that it's okay to tell God how we feel and to pray with that tone, and not to feel like we have to edit our prayers so that God somehow doesn't hear how we really feel. God knows how we feel. He wants to hear how we feel, and I think we could just look through the book of Psalms to confirm that. So Moses is frustrated. And so God deals with that. God gives Moses 70 men to help him bear the load of leadership. I wonder if this is the same 70 from Exodus 18. They kind of similar stories. But 70 men to help him bear the load. And in fact, some of them start prophesying. God says, "I'm going to take some of my spirit that I put on you and put it on them so that they can do the work like you're doing and so that you don't feel the burden of carrying this people as if they're your children." I'll just add here that when you are in a position of spiritual leadership, it is a weight, an emotional weight. And we have men here who lead us. Our job is to let them do their work with joy and not with grief, for that would not be profitable for us. I'll just add that that is not an easy burden. And here God is sensitive to that. I think we need to remember that, as easy as it makes it for us who are not in those positions of leadership, that they are dealing with things at a higher level and in a more emotionally intense way than we often give them credit for. So God deals with Moses in this way, but then he also has this promise to the people. He promises meat, but not in a good way. Not like, oh, you know what, they do deserve some meat. It is instead, verse 20, he's going to give it to them for a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, "Why did we come out of Egypt?" So you hear how God's processing this. He's saying, this is not the right heart. You're mad at me for bringing you out of Egypt, and you're kind of spitting in the face of what I've already done for you. And so God is mad. So he's going to give them meat, but it's not going to go like they want. And he gives them these quail in verse 31. There's quail that are so tall above the ground. I'm forgetting. There it is, verse 31, about 2 cubits above the ground. And so you have this huge influx of meat, and with the meat seems to come a plague. I don't know if that means that the birds were sick or something. I don't know. There's no way of knowing that. But just know that it says many of the people who had the craving die. It says specifically in verse 34, there they buried the people who had the craving. So the people are desperate in this way, and God sees it as rebellion against him. And so he punishes them, he judges them. In the same way that the fire was a judgment, this is a more direct judgment. I do wonder, too, if the people who had the craving are the ones who are going out and collecting. And so they're the ones who die because they're so desperate for something new, something different. Okay, one last story. We got 5 minutes. I don't know how much we're going to get through this. But in chapter 12, you have, in addition, Moses gets criticism from Aaron and Miriam. That is twofold. It's both personal, because he had married a Cushite woman, and it was role-related, because they say it's not just Moses that God has spoken through. He's spoken through us, too. In other words, we should be just on even keel with Moses. And so we could talk more about that. We will talk more about this complaint when we get to Korah's rebellion in chapter 16, because Korah is going to have a very similar complaint. I should be in charge, not Moses. And we'll talk about that then. But let's just leave it at this. Yahweh rebukes them personally and leaves Miriam leprous, and in fact kind of rebukes them, how could you not respect my servant Moses? I have a closer relationship with him than with anybody else, in particular than you. All right, so you get to the end of all of that, and things aren't going well. Basically, as soon as we head out from the mountain, we're following God, and then just a couple of days in, we start having complaints, and then we start having complaints about the food, and then we start having complaints about Moses, and that's just going to continue. That pattern will continue throughout these few chapters of Numbers. So are we following God in the desert? Kinda. We're following him physically, but not always with the whole heart. We're following him in the sense that we want to go where he's leading. We want the blessings he's going to give, but we're not following him in the sense of we have faith and confidence that he's taking us to in the way we want to go, to the place we want to go. So let me give you a few ideas about, I want us to think about how we can find God's heart in this. What is God trying to tell us about himself in a section like this? I first want to say, it's possible to claim to follow God while ignoring the specifics and saying, you know, that as long as I've made the major decision, like the big picture decision to follow God, the rest of it, I can still be the same person. I can still complain. I can still be rebellious and faithless in my heart. And God looks at that, and you can hear his response to that mentality in the text. That response is, that's not what I want. I don't want people who just kind of are around for the blessings and the good stuff, but don't want to actually believe in me, don't want to actually follow me and do the specific thing. We also see here that God wants us to be content with his provision. Because when you step back from this, you can see that God is actually always providing for them. It's just not the way they would want it to go. And I hope you hear how that relates to you and me, because when we look back at our lives and the times we get frustrated and down and discouraged, we don't realize that God's actually providing for us, but maybe not in the way we'd like for him to. Maybe not in a way that's as comforting as we want or as comfortable as we want. But God wants us to be content with his provision. That's not just an Old Testament principle either. That's obviously a New Testament idea as well. God wants us to be submissive to his leaders. This is really going to come up again and again in this section. Because there are going to be so many people who have power plays against Moses, and yet God's going to defend Moses for him, because Moses is the meek man who won't shut down these rebellions himself, but God does it for him, because that's what God wants. Now, I know that there's questions in our time. God obviously handpicked Moses and told everybody and showed it with signs, and that was all kind of different than what we deal with in terms of like our elders or something like that. I don't think our elders are our elders because they've thrown their rods on the ground and they all became snakes. And we said, okay, well, Steve, that's you. You're in. It's not that way, right? And yet there is that same sense that when God has people who are leading us and that we are intended to follow in order to follow God, he wants submission in those roles, even if we might see things differently from some of them, as they did with Moses. And then God wants leaders to share the load without encouraging power plays. I hope you hear both sides of that. He wants his leaders to share the load. Like, no one is intended to have more on their plate than they can do. Moses gets into that trouble. And yet, we're not encouraging power plays. We're not saying, you know what, the most ambitious person can be the one to help. In fact, God sits down the ambitious people in Numbers. Particularly, you'll see this with Korah, Dathan, and Abiram in chapter 16. But it's also going to happen where the people are complaining against Aaron in chapter 17. It's just going to keep going. And God wants both of those things at the same time. He doesn't want his people to be caught up with ambition, but he also doesn't want his leaders to be overwhelmed. So I see a lot about what God wants in this section, that all of those things to me have a direct kind of connection to the way we need to think of God. Okay, just before we end, I know I'm right at the end. New Testament connections. I just want to suggest Paul may have taken the Nazarite vow, but that idea of the vow being set apart as holy is something that's said of all Christians. It's said in 2 Timothy 2. You could put 1 Peter 1. You could put a lot of different places in the New Testament on there. That idea of we are being sanctified, and so we are God's special instruments, just the way a Nazarite was intended to be. But especially, we're going to come back to 1 Corinthians 10 several times in this section, because Paul basically preaches through this section of numbers in 1 Corinthians 10 and says, you need to know that all the people came out of Egypt and all of them went through the Red Sea, but with most of them, God was not pleased and their bodies were scattered in the wilderness because they rebelled against God, and you don't want to be like them. So if you